This is Angle of View. Today is December 9th, 2025. I'm Will Hatman. It's not every day you see the greatest play in the English language reduced to a grief therapy exercise that Shakespeare did for his quirky witch wife. It's also quite daring to suggest that before attending a performance of this play, Shakespeare's wife would never have seen a play before and wouldn't have known what a play was or generally understood the difference between fantasy and reality. But in fairness, the nightmare of mourning a dead child is bound to affect parents differently. Why shouldn't it turn the father into a genius and the mother into an idiot? This has been a review of Hamnet, which I hope will look even funnier after the film wins the Academy Award for Best Picture. Richard Linklater's Nouvelle Vague, the other new movie he released this year, I talked about Blue Moon last week, is a movie maker's movie about movies, specifically about Jean-Luc Godard and the titular movement that his extraordinary and timeless debut film Breathless brought to global awareness in 1960. Linklater seeks to capture the mythic moment when Godard traded the typewriter for the camera, following in the footsteps of his senior Cahiers du Cinéma brethren and acting upon his apocryphal quote articulated in the movie itself, which states that the best way to criticize a movie is to make your own. The cast of this French-language film is largely unknown French actors who are, at least in the case of Guillaume Marbeck as Godard and Aubrey Dulin as Jean-Paul Belmondo, utterly convincing as their subjects, as is the American actress Zoe Deutsch, who does a marvelous turn as Jean Seberg with just the right amount of bile in it. These performances are glorified impersonations, but as it makes clear that it is setting its aim at that level, the film couldn't have asked for better casting or for better work from those cast. And if you're as big a fan of Breathless as I am, and as Linklater clearly is, you can't help but get caught up in the fantasy party energy unleashed when you see the tall tales of its making reenacted, like Godard pushing his DP Raoul Coutard around in a postal cart, or crashing into the editing room on the first day of post-production and inventing jump cuts in a fit of passion. Linklater is so delighted to be casting this spell that he has made it into a kind of movie nerd Disneyland. But all this insistent optimism and officious joy has a downside, one that becomes apparent at about the speed that sunburn sets in once you're established on the beach and the novelty is worn off. It's far less a you-are-there experience, the kind from which you might learn something, or at least breathe something in, than it is a worshipful exercise in myth reinforcement. It's the kind of movie that you picture being written by someone lying on their stomach on their bed with their legs crossed at the ankle behind them and chewing on the end of a gel pen. Though in this case it was two American writers, Holly Gent and Vincent Palmo Jr., and two French translators, Michel Alberstadt and Letitia Masson. Each of the 36 or so characters pulled from history has their name displayed on screen at their first appearance. It's that kind of movie. Not an attempt to reproduce the events of Breathless's making, but an attempt to animate your wildest dream of them. Everything in it is forcefully made lovely and sprightly. Even Deutsch's frustration as the irritable Seberg is fanciful and cute, as are the budgetary woes, as are the early assertions from everyone in the orbit of the production that the movie is a disaster. And it's all to celebrate Jean-Luc Godard, the most iconoclastic burn-the-opera-house director in history. It's the same basic problem the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has. This artist would never for a second tolerate having a monument erected to him, least of all a monument in the form of a cute conventional film about the making of his radical film. It's probably not coincidental that it was not released while he lived. Joachim Trier's Sentimental Value is a cry of pity for the poor artists who can only love through their work, where they are protected by the armor of form and the promise of total control. The film also has tears to spare for the children of these artists, who need a more direct love from their parents than they can ever get. But even as it suggests that the worst possible outcome for such a child is for them to grow up into an artist and inherit their parents' deficiency, the film still ultimately breaks in favor of the parent, coming to rest on the tough truth that a devotion to art excuses the abandonment of personal responsibilities and operating in a spirit of apologia. This ruling makes for a frustrating conclusion not because it is unjust, but because it is facile, and particularly because the movie had spent most of its running time avoiding the facile and serving the richer and harder idea that there is no position from which such a situation can be fairly judged. When you see it hurrying at the end to attempt exactly that, and doing it purely out of panicked recognition that it needs an ending of some kind, it registers as a letdown. The artist parent in this case is a hard-nosed Norwegian film director, Gustav Borg, played by Stellan Skarsgård. And the victims of his withholding are his daughters, actress Nora, Renate Reinsve, and her sister Agnes, Inga Ibsdotter Lilleas, who as a child had starred in what became her father's best-loved movie but has since given it up to be a historian. If Trier, aged 51, identifies more closely with the parent, we shouldn't be too surprised. I don't know if he has kids of his own. If so, then part of his motivation here could be to get ahead of something. But either way, he seems to feel some guilt about whatever sacrifices he makes for the sake of his art, and the guilt gives rise to a defensive second voice that responds from elsewhere inside him, and this tennis match is basically the movie. If the theme is a bit of an overreach for sympathy on Trier's part, a window into his unique Norwegian upper-middle-class torment, it still makes for an affecting story as such things go, because the film stays humble in its explorations of it. It has a light hand and a deliberate pace, and what at least passes for most of the duration as an open heart, which shows in the fact that it takes a genuine lingering interest in everyone involved in the story. The humility shines out not only by comparison to earlier runs at the same subject, like Bergman's lugubrious Autumn Sonata or Woody Allen's pathetic Deconstructing Harry, but also by comparison to Trier's previous film, The Worst Person in the World, which could have been a moving slice of life about the dislocation of contemporary young adults, but for the fact it took it upon itself to dispense grand truths about love and mortality and the wonders of happenstance. In the final analysis, The Worst Person in the World was just a much better and more careful enactment of the same everything is beautiful pap at the heart of something like The Life of Chuck, or at least that's what I might say about it on my meanest day. Sentimental value never puts on those kinds of airs. The impulse to make proclamations is one that Trier and his co-writer Eskil Vogt seem to have shed in the time since. The dramatic table is set with real skill here, and Trier stays firmly down on its level, holding the story to its terms and never seeming tempted to distill its elements or hurl them skyward. The starting gun of the plot is that Gustav's ex-wife and the mother to his two daughters dies, and he attends the wake in the old house in Oslo that the women were raised in and that he still owns. The historic absence of Gustav from his daughters' lives is thinly sketched, but this is acceptable given that the movie explores it primarily from their point of view rather than his, and you can't sketch what you can't see. There is also an attempt on the film's part by way of voiceover to frame some of these memories as though they belong to the house itself, and this is one of its bewildering stumbles, though it doesn't do lasting damage. There are some flashbacks to a house alternately full of shouting and chilled by silence, but we are mostly made to fill in the picture of the women's childhood by observing how their father interacts with them now as adults, and this is powerfully suggestive stuff. Gustav's narcissism and hunger for personal validation is not nakedly malignant, but constantly seeping through, as in an early scene when he meets Nora at a restaurant, orders something for her by referring to her as the lovely young lady, and then snickers to his daughter that the server probably thinks they're a couple. It starts to get interesting as we sit for long stretches with each character following this bumpy reunion. There are suggestions that Gustav's warped attitudes toward love and human connection in life versus in simulation have been passed down to Nora, and that being an actress, Nora might be taking a heavier dose than Dad did. And this is put in contrast to the coping strategy chosen by Agnes, who has simply fled from it all and tried to live her life by engaging as few memories of her upbringing as possible. We learn early that prior to their mother's wake, she and Nora weren't even speaking much anymore. But we also discover that Gustav has a wound of his own, the suicide of his mother, a World War II resistance fighter who had been imprisoned and tortured by the Nazis when he was a boy. It turns out that Gustav, not only long estranged from both his daughters, but inactive as an artist for many years, has written a new film about a mother to a young boy who succumbs to depression and takes her own life, and that the real reason he came to Oslo to attend his ex-wife's wake was so that he could have the chance to ask Nora to star in it. He denies, when asked, that the character in his movie is his mother, which is amusing at first blush because it's what all fiction writers say when asked such questions. And if you know fiction writers, you know that they're not dissembling when they say this, though you also know that the obvious real-life analog is still part of the character mix because there's no other way it could be. But the painful truth that emerges as we watch is that the amalgam of Gustav's suicidal character includes not only his mother, but also both his daughters. His film is not so much a reckoning with the great trauma of his childhood as it is a penance to his own children, an admission that he let them down and that he recognizes the pain they consequently carry around as adults. Agnes is more outwardly depressed than Nora, and between the two women is the one with a young son, whom Gustav, very soon after meeting him, decides he also wants to cast in his movie as the young son. His offering the part to Nora is another penance that would seal the first one, and her refusal of him keeps the pain alive and swirling between them. The most potent stuff in the movie is happening when this film of Gustav's is the radiant center, the glowing wire running through the family history, and the prism that sends its light outward. But after it has used this premise to expand to a maximum of emotional complexity, the story starts to shrink back down, and ultimately it comes off too composed for anything to hit as hard as it ought to. This, interestingly, is a problem that The Worst Person in the World didn't have. The sloppy fit of its chapters was its most endearing quality. The voiceover in that film was affectionately bemused. Here, it is one long, sober sigh. There are scattered moments of real earned tenderness in the film, like a bittersweet scene of Gustav meeting with his old trusted cinematographer and realizing with horror that the man's age and frailty and drinking have compromised his ability to work, and then hopping from that realization to a new, clean-scrubbed terror of his own decline. Or a gorgeous late scene of reconnection between Nora and Agnes, whose childhood pain had driven a wedge between them despite its common source, but who realized that their childhood is over, and they can now be, for each other, the support beams that neither of them had ever had before. But in structural terms, the narrative pieces begin to join together too snugly, and the last act is spent smoothing them all the more, as when a late reveal takes the link between Gustav's mother and Nora and slaps a new detail on it that literalizes it and hoists it up into the foreground. We realize around this point that a lot of the complexity that had been so thoughtfully engineered between Gustav's movie and his real family life was simply told to us, and that what the movie is now telling us is that maybe it doesn't have to be so messy after all, and who's to say these people can't find a way to a clean resolution? All throughout this family drama about disappointment and resentment, tastefulness keeps us from any real bitter flavors. Despite multiple quotes of Michael Haneke, the extremely severe Austrian director, some of which show up in Gustav Borg's style, Trier's film nimbly dances around the kinds of intolerable feelings that Haneke's best films exist to confront. And though the side of the movie that defends Gustav never overtly states the position that a dramatic artist can't afford to spend love on their family because it must all be saved for their work, as though it were a finite resource, one of the great annoyances in the film is the mythic status that Gustav's new script takes on as it circulates among the characters. We learn almost none of the actual contents of the script, but we never hear the end of the characters, up to and finally including his daughters, talking about what a flawless masterpiece it is, and how deeply it understands emotional pain. What we do hear of it, a single monologue that two different characters read, isn't all that special, except insofar as what it illuminates about the two characters reading it. So we are to infer that whatever neglect and exploitation Gustav inflicted upon his kids must have been worth it, because this amazing script of his might not have been as good had it been informed by less real suffering. After all, the sorrows of life are the joys of art, right? But are the joys of art a fair substitute for basic emotional health? And can you offer them up as such a substitute to your sad, grown child and hope that it will suffice as recompense, that it will actually function as a gift and an act of contrition, rather than as just another instance of a narcissist dramatist using their kids in their work and forcing them to be involved in their mess on their terms? Trier seems to think so, and it seems less a frail, beautiful hope than a pillar installed as a psychological necessity, something that needs to be true or else. This is the tone of the film's final note, the off-puttingly tidy wrap-up, which says that we simply must accept these artists and their crippled love because it's the best they can give of themselves and is better than nothing. It is in this scene that the film's aversion to ugliness nearly becomes an affirmative expression. The film never gives any sense of why it is better to play their game than to walk away, except that Nora is an artist too. But while this fact could have stoked an ambiguity in the resolution, is Nora's embrace of her father on the plane of dramatization a capitulation or a step toward real healing? The fuzzy tone suggests the latter too straightforwardly. There is sadness in the film's climax over the time that the characters can't get back, but that's not the same thing as darkness. Craft is perhaps the level on which the film is best enjoyed, which, given this theme, is probably not something Trier would want to hear. Neither Skarsgård nor Reinsver were ever better, and most of the power in the film issues from their silent glances. A juxtaposition of an early wordless exchange between them and a later one could serve as a summary of the movie's primary arc. Lilias is the film's unrecognized third champion. Her Agnes has a far smaller arc than Nora, informed by far less actual interaction with her father, but the way Lilias works the mask that her face is settled into is exquisite. The way it hardens up when she senses her father getting too close to his grandson, and then melts just a little when she and Nora embrace. Lastly, Elle Fanning, in the thankless role of the American movie star with whom Gustav proceeds on the film after Nora turns him down, has an unforgettable scene in which her character reads the most transparent of the suicidal mother's monologues, the one that sets the benchmark for the far deeper read that Nora will offer up at the end. She is utterly earnest and professional, and is obviously pushing herself in a way she never has before, and cries real tears at the table read, and is all wrong for the part in a TV-ish way that Gustav immediately grasps and that his reaction cannot hide. It's a flourish of ironic virtuosity from Fanning. I can't even imagine how good an actor you have to be to convincingly play a C-minus actor who, through immense toil, has achieved a B-minus. My theme music is by me and Johann Wagner. My logo design is by Aaron Robert Miller. Find these and more than 1,000 of my other reviews in writing at letterboxd.com/QUILLH. I'm Will Hatman, and I'll keep watching if you do.